If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. My name is Tony Bruschi. Let's head to the courtroom for segment number four.
The jury is present, sir.
Hey, here, cross-examination.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to begin by going over a few of your qualifications, you know, what we heard about kind of at the beginning of your testimony. Is your practice focused primarily on, would you agree your practice is kind of focused primarily on accident reconstruction?
I would say so, and failure analysis.
And that would be in your advertisements online and your CV that you provided?
Well, probably on a website. We really don't advertise, but definitely on my CV.
The website.
Right? Yes.
And most of the work you've done would have been in that field, the accident reconstruction or analyzing things to do with mostly civil litigation. Would that be fair to say?
I would say, yes, that's fair. Most of the work that the company does company-wide is civil litigation, and so accident reconstruction, but that's a pretty broad description because, for instance, I have civil engineers, I have biomedical engineers, so they deal with a lot of different subject matters.
And primarily civil litigation, even though it's a broad area, civil litigation.
Exactly.
Very good. And your client today is the defense, is that correct?
Yes.
And you were retained by them. When were you retained?
Jim Griffin called me, I want to say it was about the middle of September of 2022.
And I know we've seen your PowerPoint. Did you is that your report, or did you prepare a separate report for defense?
The written report that I did in this case was on the acoustics testing, but the PowerPoint was just trying to pull. You know, it's a big file, of course, but just trying to pull it all into one place.
Did you provide any additional reports to count to defense, or was the PowerPoint the only one?
Just the PowerPoint, and then I had maybe a 4 to 5 page report on the results of the acoustics testing.
And when did you finalize your PowerPoint that we just saw today?
In its final form, that would have been yesterday.
So you finalized your PowerPoint one day before your trial?
Yes.
Okay. Is that standard for you to do?
Yes.
All right. And what's your how much are you getting paid for your services?
So the company charges $350 an hour for my time.
And how many hours have you worked on this case?
Oh, Lord. A lot. I couldn't give you an idea, but I made two trips down here. I've been to Moselle twice. I read through a bunch of documents, you know, studied pictures forever, got ready for trial. Of course, that took a while. I would probably say that I have, you know, somewhere between 40, 50 hours in this case.
40 to 50? Is that your estimate?
I would think so.
And travel incurs additional expenses. Is that why you kind of mentioned it separately?
It does, yes. Yeah. So, yeah, the company charges anytime I'm traveling or working.
Have you ever done any work for the law firm formerly known as PMPED?
No. I've had, because I've been doing this for so long, and I do a lot of railroad cases, I have been on the other side of that law firm, and I've been deposed, like on the other side. They took my deposition. I was on the other side working for a defendant. But I've never worked for them directly, like on, say, a personal injury case or a wreck case.
Have you ever been retained by to work on the boat case?
Yes, I did. Okay.
Tell me about that. What was your retention for the boat case? And by the boat case, which one are you referring? Which one? What do you understand that to be?
Well, the boat case, the Maori Beach case. So the one that occurred down at Parris Island. So I do boat accidents. I do, you know, small vessel, watercraft, jet skis. I've actually worked on ship accidents, ship collisions before. So I do a lot of maritime and boat accident work. And I was called by Jim Griffin a few years ago. It would have been probably, you know, within a few months of that accident. And I did an investigation of the boat crash.
Does do your services also include a retainer? Like, is there some sort of retainer to work off of before the hourly billing kicks in?
No. Our company is pretty simple. We just bill by the hour. So we don't do contracts or retainers. Some people in my field of work do.
So you're originally retained by Mr. Griffin for the boat case to do a boat reconstruction. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Okay.
And that would be in line with your, you know, what you primarily do with your services at your firm. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that just falls underneath physics, mechanical engineering. Anything based in physics has the potential for being explained, and that's what I do.
All right, and I know your educational background is in engineering. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you know, I want to talk about a few things we can maybe agree on. And engineering is a field that. Would you agree engineering is a field that is based in science? Would
yes.
you agree with that?
Yes.
Would you agree that engineering is a field that's based in some math? Is that fair to say?
There's a lot of math in engineering, yes.
We heard a lot about trigonometry and angles. I mean, math, right?
Yes.
Engineering's based, a lot of, is based in hard facts. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And engineering, some of the things that really have no business in engineering would be guesswork. Is that fair to say?
Well, in engineering, you can sometimes make assumptions and then make guesses, but you always have to go back and test them, right? You develop what we call them hypothesis, right? So you look at the problem, you try to figure out what the problem is, you form a hypothesis, and then you test it. So, you know, you might say, well, I think this, and then you either mathematically or physically test it.
Okay. Going back to that question about guesswork, though, because I don't know that you answered it. In engineering, is it important not to use guesswork in making opinions?
Right. If I give an opinion, I'm not guessing. So whenever I give an opinion, there is a foundation based on my education, experience, and training for me to give that opinion.
So if an opinion's rendered and there's variables that aren't considered, would you consider that to be guesswork?
Well, it depends on how important the variables are. I mean, any engineer in any analysis procedure, you know, there could be lots of variables that don't matter. But if the variable matters, then of course, you know, that would affect your opinion.
And in engineering, you know, and we're thinking of, I think you said you're a mechanical engineer?
Yes.
By education?
Yes.
So do mechanical engineers engage in speculation?
Not in the context of giving opinions.
Okay. And do mechanical engineers, when they're whatever they're engineering or whatever they're opining about, do they base their opinion on assumptions?
Not primarily, not even really. Your opinions can't be based on assumptions. Now, there can be aspects of your analysis that you have to test, but just but you know whether it's an assumption or a guess, that does not make for a good engineering opinion.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Are you a member of any? Have you had any formal training in pathology?
No.
Have you had any formal training in firearms or firearms? How they work?
No.
Are you a member of any organizations that do that line of work, that do tests on firearms or pathology?
No.
Have you taken any shooting incident reconstruction classes?
No.
Do you have any certifications in shooting incident and reconstruction?
No.
Do you have any? Have you taken any classes in gunshot wounds?
No.
Have you ever done any studies on bullet trajectory from out of the muzzle of a gun?
Yes.
Okay. What studies have you done?
I've done all kinds of testing.
Such as?
For instance, one time I had a case. It was a murder case where a person was shot through a car door and was shot with a .357 Magnum. And the door had maybe 6 bullet holes, and each of the bullet holes had different characteristics. So I went to the junkyard and got 25 to 30 of these doors, and I spent a couple of weeks shooting that door with a .357 Magnum at different angles, different distances, until I could replicate the bullet holes in the actual in the door. So what you're doing there is that you have a door as evidence, and then you're trying to figure out, okay, what does that tell you? Not the same as what I talked about today, but similar. I had a case one time where there were 2 deer hunters in the woods and one got shot at long range. So we did a lot of long range ballistic testing of the ammunition in the firearm to determine the drop distance of the bullet and to understand where the one hunter would have to aim the weapon. I have done proximity testing with firearms. By looking at the stippling. So in other words, I have a rig that I can put a pistol in, and then I put target. A lot of times I use sheetrock. And then what I do is I fire the gun at increments back and look at the pattern of the stippling. Sometimes you'll get soot and stippling and sometimes that. So it would all be testing within the context of the cases. You know, when I get involved in a firearms case, those are the types of things types of tests that I would do. It's just a general part of our business. When we get presented with an engineering problem, we do testing.
And those testing, any of those studies that you did, were they subject to peer review or published in any publication?
No, I typically don't write papers or submit papers. I do the work.
So it's you doing a test on your own?
Yes.
Is that right? That's what it is?
Yes, or with, you know, of course, people in my office helping.
With your office?
Yes.
Okay. And are you a member of the International Association for Identifications?
No.
Firearms identifications?
No.
Do you have any certifications along those lines whatsoever?
No, I'm not a firearms expert or a pathologist or a wound expert. That's not my area of physics. It's not my area of expertise.
Okay. So is it fair to say then any opinion you rendered on relating to firearms, we shouldn't rely on it then?
That's not what I said.
Okay.
If it's related to exterior ballistics and terminal ballistics, then you can certainly rely upon it. But I'm not going to testify about wounds or pathology or anything like that, and I haven't.
Okay. All right. I want to start with the cell phone. I think we ended on the last slide. The charts. I don't know where those are. Yeah. I'm showing you defense exhibit 141 and 142. I believe you testified. Can I have the PowerPoint? Oh, sorry. I believe you testified that you created these graphs. Is that right?
No, I didn't. This is an Excel graph from the data. So it's just the raw data that was presented to me.
All right, well, who created it then?
I'm not sure. I just reviewed it. I'm not sure who did this.
All right, well, can you tell me, I think you testified before that at, well, show me the time, if you would, and permission for the witness to come down. Show me the time that you indicated the phone was thrown from the car, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I got it specifically on my laptop. I can show you in general. It's up to you. I mean,
well, this is an evidence, so I'm asking for you to come down and identify on here where it is.
You want to know where the car passed, where the phone was?
And just for clarification, yeah, 1 second, sorry. Just for clarification, we're looking at this chart. What is this showing us?
That is a graph of the speed of the Suburban versus time. So speed is on the y-axis, or this is speed, mm-hmm. and then that's time. So time's going that way. And as the car speeds up, the line gets taller.
Okay. And it says total time 16 minutes. What does that refer to?
That's the time it took to drive from Moselle to the parents' house.
Okay. And the sled, and then it says next to that sled test drive during day. What does that indicate?
What that is it's just comparing. It took 16 minutes, Mr. Murdoch, and then sled did it. Sled did the same drive. Not at nighttime, but during the day, and took 17.58 minutes.
Okay. All right. So as I was saying before, I think you testified. You said you indicated a point where the cell phone had been thrown from the vehicle, or at least the time correlation. Could you please identify where that is for us?
No, that's not what I said.
All right. Well, what did you say then?
I said that when the car passes the location.
Okay.
Right. I don't have any information about
when the car passes the location. Where is it indicated?
I think it's that line right there.
Okay. And you say you think. Why is it that you think?
Well, it's not labeled, but it's on my laptop. I'd be glad to get my laptop.
Well, this is an evidence, and this is what the jury's going to consider. So I prefer to work on this.
Objection. He has indicated he has a specific date on his laptop. If he wants the real answer, he'll be happy to walk to his laptop and get it for him. He says he's looked at this. That's where it is. I mean, he's asked the question three times. He's answered three times.
Cross-examination. You may proceed.
You're not able to find it on here, are you? Looking at this chart.
Well, it's either this line right there, or I think it's this one or this one.
All right, does engineering engage in I thinks and maybes?
Let me get my laptop.
Well, I'm just asking you, can you identify it on this chart?
Well, I mean, this is a really big file.
Your Honor, I'd ask the witness, please answer the question.
Well, I will answer it, but I don't have the whole file memorized, so let me just look at it for you. That way, we'll know the answer.
Can you point it out on this chart without reviewing whatever you're about to review on your laptop?
No. Okay.
Can you identify 912 on this chart without reviewing anything you're about to review on your laptop?
Well, I mean, you want me to answer the first question?
You answered it. You said no. Can you identify where on 912 on this chart is?
No, they're not. Okay. They're, it doesn't have any numbers written down.
Thank you. Can you identify where 920 is on this chart?
Well, hold on. You want me to answer your questions, or you want me to answer the first question?
The questions, please. Can you identify where 920 is on this chart?
No, because there are no numbers on this, but it's...
And can you identify where 952...
His answer.
Let's give the witness an opportunity to answer the question.
Can you identify where 952 is on this chart?
Not specifically.
Okay, thank you. You can sit down on it.
I'm showing you what's been marked as defense, exhibit 142.
And same thing, there's no numbers, there's no times on here either, right?
No, not on the x-axis at the bottom.
Switch to the PowerPoint, please. All right, you gave an opinion on objects being thrown, ejected, traveling at what was posited to you as 45 miles an hour. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Opinion? What are some variables, and you're an engineer with math background, what are some variables you would need to know before determining the distance, trajectory, and speed of an object?
Like is the hypothetical if somebody threw a phone out of a window?
My hypothetical is, in order to determine the speed of any object, what are some variables that you would need to know in order to determine the distance it was thrown, the trajectory it was thrown, and the speed at which it was thrown? What are some information that you would need to know in order to posit an opinion about that?
Well, there would be a lot of variables, but the main ones would be, and I think I understand your question, but let's say you find an object on the side of the road, and you want to know how fast, let's just assume that somebody throws something out of a car that's driving down the road. And let's say this would be a typical problem people ask me or were presented with. It's like, well, can you calculate based on the physical evidence on the side of the road, how fast was the car traveling when the phone was thrown out? I mean, let's just look at it that way. So what you would need to know, like, let's say that it was on the shoulder of a road and there was like an impact mark on the shoulder of the road. And then 57 feet later is the phone, right? So you could make a pretty good determination. The phone tumbled 57 feet. Well, a tumbling object decelerates at about a half a G. That's 11 miles per hour per second. So over 57 feet, you could back calculate it. You're going to come up with something probably like 30 miles per hour, right? The variables would be the condition of the shoulder, obviously the speed that it's thrown out, right?
Energy, right?
Right, because for instance, if you're driving down the road, you could throw it forward, you could throw it backwards. So you may want to add the speed or subtract the speed from the velocity of the vehicle.
And I'm going to let you keep going, but okay. Just
answer the question, interrupt it again.
Were you through answering that question?
I think so. I think that's probably all
right. Next question.
All right. About the strength, I think you said strength of the throw. Is that what you were talking about when we last cut?
Well,
variables.
Right, because if you just drop the phone from the car, it has zero initial velocity relative to the car, but the car has relative velocity to the road. So, for instance, it's going to have a different trajectory if you throw it straight down out your window than it would be if you throw it up in the air or throw it sideways. Those are all what's called initial conditions. And so, but, you know, if you had information, let's say you had a witness in the passenger seat that said, well, he tossed it straight out of the window, then you could calculate it that way. But you would need more information. So, to know specifically this type of problem, you would need to know a lot of different information to get if you said, how fast is this car going based on how far that phone tumbled down the street? Yeah, you would need to know some more information.
So you'd need to know the energy thrown, at which the object was thrown, correct?
Yes, or the speed.
Would you need to know the mass of the object that was thrown?
No.
That wouldn't matter?
No.
Would you need to know the wind resistance, if any?
Yes.
Would you need to know the wind speed, if any?
It depends on the problem, but that might be a factor.
And absent any of those variables, really can't tell anything about an object that was thrown. Is that fair to say?
Well, it depends on the question that's asked. If you were asking me the question, how fast were the car going, then yes, you would need all those variables unless you wanted a wide range of answers. But if you ask me, if you toss a phone at near highway speed or close to highway speed, will it tumble? It's a completely different question. There's no variables there. That's just fact.
Okay. And while this may be obvious, I'm going to show you what's been marked, what's been entered into evidence as State's Exhibit 230. I'm sorry, I keep doing that to you. Is this the side of the road that you visited?
It looks like it.
Does that look like it also? I'm showing you States 231.
Yes, I know there's woods on the east side and there's an open field on the west side.
You know, I'll just do this the old-fashioned. And does that look like a shot from the side of the road that you visited on Moselle?
Yes.
And what are we seeing here in the background? What are we seeing?
Well, in the background, there's the field that's over on the west side of the...
All right. In front of the field, what is that?
That's the roadway.
Okay. And in front of that road, right in front of the road on the picture, the green stuff?
Grass shoulder.
All right. And then near at the bottom of the screen, what are we seeing?
It's like vegetation, leaves, sticks.
You'd agree that leaves and grass is fairly soft. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Showing you what's been entered as 232. Different angles. That look at the same road to you?
Yes, that's looking basically north.
And again, grass, right, on the side of the road?
Yes, that's on the west shoulder.
When you do sound studies, have you done work? Is it primarily for like OSHA related things, or I know you mentioned some companies? Is that what the sound studies have primarily been for?
It's typically the work that I do now.
Sound studies?
Yes, the acoustics measurements that I do typically would be related to train whistles, train horns, emergency vehicles, backup alarms where, say, somebody gets backed over with a truck, audibility of backup alarms. I've had audibility of warning alarms inside of a factory. Like, you know, could a worker hear the alarm and then get out of an area that was dangerous? So it's usually emergency signals. Is typical. I have worked on a criminal case where it wasn't a gunshot, it was a woman screaming. And could a particular, they call them ear witnesses instead of eyewitnesses, but could a particular ear witness hear a woman screaming at a distance? So,
and it would that be for workplace considerations? There was some accident at work and it maybe relates to OSHA?
No, this was a murder case.
Oh, the other things you mentioned previously, sorry.
No, the other ones, I mean, typically are going to be civil litigation. Okay. Where, you know, you might have a dump truck manufacturer getting sued for not having an audible alarm that's, you know, loud enough or just plain, or sometimes what happens in a car accident, but like a back over accident, they're saying that the person that got run over should have heard the truck coming and got out of the way, right? So people argue back and forth about who could hear and not hear, like a backup alarm.
All right, I'm going to direct your attention now to the sound study that you conducted, and it was in your PowerPoint of your defense exhibit. Defense exhibit 140, and I guess digitally 143. All right, if you could please to page, I believe 75 or exhibit 76. Okay, there you go. All right, and remind me again, and I know it's visual there, but what's the distance between the dog kennels and the house right there?
Straight line distance is 142 feet.
1,140?
Oh, what did I say?
I think you said 140.
Oh, yeah, 1, no, it's like 1,150 feet. Let's just call it 1,150. 1,150.
All right. And that's as the crow flies, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, please continue over to exhibits. If you just fast forward for me, sorry, I'm trying to find the number. Exhibit 1, just if you keep going, I'll stop you on the 300 blackout. All right, this ammunition, what kind of ammunition is that?
300 blackout, 147 grain, full metal jacket.
Okay. And do you know who the manufacturer of that is?
It looks like Cellier and Below.
Okay. All right. And that's the ammunition you used on the 300 blackout test?
Yes.
All right. If you would fast forward a couple. And this is this your rifle?
No.
Okay. Is this a person's rifle that was working for you?
No. This was a the lawyer, Jim Griffin, provided the two weapons.
Okay. Did you yourself test actually fire these weapons?
No. An engineer in my office, his name's Michael Whitley. So since I was running the acoustic equipment up in the house, then Michael Whitley was the one that actually pulled the trigger.
And are you familiar with this type of firearm?
Yes.
All right. What is that?
Well, it's a 300 blackout, which is the name of the ammunition. And so basically what it is an AR-15 style rifle with a shorter barrel. And when they shortened the barrel, they needed a specially designed ammo for it so it would be efficient. In other words, it's the type of weapon that might be used in close quarters. So it's shorter and you can move around and maneuver. But when you cut the barrel down to, say, 8 or 9 inches, you need to chamber a different round. That's basically what this is.
And is it actually, are you aware it's actually considered a pistol for purposes of government identifications?
I don't know if this particular one is considered a pistol or not. Like I said, I'm not a gun expert.
Okay. But, that's fine. Yeah. All right, if you would please fast forward to, there we go. All right, this, reverse one, please. Thank you. All right, this picture, what are we looking at?
That's the ammunition. That's the buckshot that we used.
All right, and is there a reason you chose this particular brand?
The Winchester was similar to the brand of ammunition used.
What kind of ammunition is this type?
It's a 12-gauge buckshot. It's like 2 3/4-inch shells. I want to say that the buckshot in the murder was maybe a 3-inch shell, but okay. This is a similar load.
So similar but not the same?
That's correct.
And not the same manufacturer?
I think it was Federal. I'd have to go back and look. But I think there was Federal and maybe Winchester. Okay. The reason is just because I know that the plastic shot cups were found at the crime scene, and I think that's Winchester. But I would have to go look.
Okay. But you concede you didn't use the same gauge for buckshot as was used in the murder of Paul Murdoch?
No. It's probably slightly different.
Okay. All right. If you would please continue to Exhibit 7. And again, what do we have here?
That would be the turkey load or bird shot with the smaller pellets that we used.
And again, this is not the same load that was used in the murder of Paul Murdoch.
I don't think it's the exact same. It's just representative.
All right. All right. If you would, please go to Exhibit 24. I think it's like 2 or 3 slides. There you go, right there. Thank you. All right. And again, this is the interior of the house at Mizell. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I believe you already testified to it, but what was the ambient decibel reading inside that house?
35 decibels, pretty much steady state.
And is that, well, I guess we heard an audio clip, right?
Yes.
That we played for the jury. Does the ability to hear something, is it affected by the ambient noise?
Yes,
in
that's
a room?
Yes.
Did you do a test on what the ambient noise is in this courtroom?
No, I can do it right now if you want me to.
Did you do it before? Does the ambient noise have an effect on how we hear something?
Yes, that's what I explained. So in order for you to be able to clearly hear something, it's got to be 10 decibels above background.
And we've heard,
it's 10 decibels below background, you're not going to be able to hear it. And when you're in between, it depends on if you're listening for it. Like if you're really listening for something, like if you're at a train crossing and you're listening for the train horn, it could be right at the background level, like you've got the radio on a little bit. The train horn could be right at the background level, but since you're listening for it, you might be able to hear it. If you're not paying attention, then you might not. But if it's 10 decibels above your background, you will hear it. 10 decibels below, you're not going to hear it. Because, again, that's twice as loud or twice as soft.
And it sounds relative, and I know you gave an example of the concert how did you decide, or how did anyone decide what volume to play that sound clip? Would volume affect your ability to hear something?
It does, but it really wouldn't matter because, again, the shot from the kennels was only 1 to 3 dB above background. So it was about 36, 37, 38 decibels. And even if you rustle a piece of paper, that could be in the 50s. And so it doesn't really, in this case, the volume of the TV, it really didn't matter just because the sound of the gun inside that house is so faint, it wouldn't make a difference.
All right. And I know this may be outside your expertise, but just asking you common sense, are you aware that trees generally grow?
Yes.
So remind me again, what day did you go out and perform these sound tests?
The sound tests were January 5 of this year, so 23.
And I know we have some pictures. If you wouldn't mind backing it up to Exhibit 14. It's the closest representation I could find. Okay, right there is fine. Sorry. Would this tree line on the back of picture Exhibit 10 be consistent with what you saw in January?
Yes, that is January.
Okay. And are you aware of what the date of the murder was?
That's June the 7th of 21. So basically, this picture's taken, let's say, 18 months later, 19 months later?
And I think you did testify that sounds, because speed travels in a straight line, sound would be affected by the tree line. Is that correct?
It will be on the other side of the tree line. It's also going straight up, too. It's like I said before, it's like a big half bubble getting bigger. The trees probably obviously did grow in the year and a half when it happened. And I did make correction for the trees, but it was only, I think it was 1.7 dB, if I recall. But so the trees made a difference, but not that big of a difference.
Well, without being there in whatever the tree height were, would that have an effect on the sound level? I mean, I think you said you accommodated 1.7 dB, but will you agree that the height of a tree or a forest would have an effect on the sound?
Oh, it'll have an effect, but in this case, it's two. Let's just call it 2 decibels. And what I'm talking about is, background inside the house. If you had the TV on, is like 70 decibels, right? So we're comparing 35 or 40 decibels. Whether we add or subtract 2, it makes no difference because you got 70 versus 30 or 40. And remember, just 10 decibels is twice as loud. So 70 decibels is many, many times louder. So I went through the process of making sure that the numbers were correct. But minor variables such as wind, humidity, wind speed, the trees, all of those, even if you factored all of those in, it really doesn't make a difference just because the gunshot inside the house was so faint that you're just not going to hear it.
All right, if you wouldn't mind turning to Exhibit 25, please. It would be toward the end, forward. It's a chart. Yeah, the next one. Next one, if you wouldn't mind, this chart. Okay. What's the decibels of a vacuum cleaner at 3 meters and a gas lawnmower at 30 meters? What's the decibel reading on that?
70.
It'd be 70?
Yes.
And you said the TV was at 70?
68 to 70.
So the same as a vacuum cleaner running and a gas lawnmower?
Well, the lawnmower is what, at 30 meters, which is, just 100 checking. Feet. It must be a pretty quiet vacuum cleaner because of in my experience, a vacuum cleaner is a lot louder than 70 decibels.
What was the decibel reading that you measured for the shotgun blast again?
Around 154, I believe. It's on the next slide.
And what was the reading for the rifle?
165.
I think you talked about extrapolation. You know what I'm referring to? Extrapolating the sound over distance?
Yes.
Okay. And I think you said, but the sound dissipates 6 decibels for every twice the distance. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
And that's what you testified to?
Yes.
So if you wouldn't mind, could you extrapolate for me? So at 165, which is what the rifle tested at, could you reverse extrapolate that to 1,024 feet? Could you do the math?
Yes, I have that. Well, it's actually a slide, but I've got the chart. If you give me a second. Okay. So what I did was, when you add in the attenuation, what distance do you want to know?
1,024 feet.
So basically just like outside the house?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just the basic. Okay, so... So because of the weather conditions, I adjusted the number up for, I'm assuming we want to talk about the night of the murders, right?
I just want to know if you could reverse if you could extrapolate, I don't want to know about weather conditions or anything right now. I just want to extrapolate 165 decibels beginning at, 3 feet beginning at 3 feet. And then I want to extrapolate it to 1,024 feet. And those are even numbers.
It's 89.5 decibels.
Could you repeat that, please?
Yes, 89.5 decibels. Let's just say you're just right outside the house.
Wait, what are you saying? Right outside the house?
Yes. Inside the house, it's in my other report. Inside the house, it was maybe 35 to 38 decibels inside the house.
I'll come back to that. I don't want to know inside the house, outside the house. I just want to know in a lab setting, you have a 165 decibel blast.
Right.
Measured at 3 feet. So 165 decibels at 3 feet. If you extrapolated that out for distance, what would the decibel be? Just lab setting. What would the mathematical equation be?
Well, it would be a little bit different in a lab setting. This is not a lab setting. But if you did... You go, I don't have that written out. You may have already done it, but if you take 3 feet.
Would you disagree? Let me ask you this, it's not a trick question. Lab setting, we can put all the qualifications in, but would it be at 1,024 feet? Would you have any reason to doubt that it would be at 105 decibels?
That sounds about right. I think I did that at one point in time and got about the same number you did.
And if you wouldn't mind, what is your chart indicating is at 105 decibels?
Let's see.
Just what the chart says.
It says jet flight at 300 meters, which is basically 1,000 feet. Okay.
Thank you. Would you agree that a cat's meowing or a cat is fairly low on the decibel meter?
Yes.
Certainly if a cat was outside and you're inside... Fairly low, hard to hear. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, unless the window's open.
All right. I'm going to reverse and now go to, if you wouldn't mind, starting at page or exhibit 57. Does it go backwards? Yeah, you have to keep going. Just the first part of this. There we go. Thank you. All right. Referring to your exhibit 57 on your PowerPoint, I know you testified to, but are you familiar with what this image shows?
Yes.
All right. And this is the feed room with the a view of the window. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this is not a picture you took. Is that fair to say?
No, this is the night crime scene pictures from June 7th.
All right. Do you just visually looking at it, do you see holes in the window?
Yes.
Okay. Do you see a whole lot of other stuff in that picture? On the shelves, in front of it, behind it, below it, above it?
Yes.
All right. If you wouldn't please continue on to the next slides. I'm going to go to your exhibit 45. It's going the other way, towards the end of it. Right there. Our 44 is fine. All right, so I think you testified that you kind of visually looked through the hole in the window and kind of aligned your eye with the tree outside. Is that kind of how it went?
No.
You said you, correct me if I'm wrong, you can tell me in a second, but didn't you say you lowered your head to where you perceived a chest wound would be and looked out the window and tried to align it with that defect?
Yes.
Okay. So the only thing I missed was lowering your head, right?
Right, and I didn't do it at the window. I did it in the middle of the room.
Now, we've already established you have no training, experience, or expertise in shotguns. Is that correct?
Well, maybe you need to explain a little bit more.
Well, what do you have any formal training, formal expertise, formal education in how shotguns work, how shotgun projectiles work, and what they do after leaving the end of that barrel? Do you have any formal training, expertise, certifications, anything?
Not formal training, but I've done a lot of study, and I've also tested shotguns, and I've fired many shotguns before. I understand what happened to the pellets, and this particular pellet is one of the pellets that would have passed through Paul.
All right. What's the spread of a shotgun pellet exiting a shotgun barrel? What's the spread every 1 inch?
Well, it's going to vary based on the choke and the ammunition, but for this one, it's pretty clear that the spread is about the size of a window, because the muzzle of the shotgun was maybe, let's call it, 3 feet inside the door. It's a 10-foot long room. So at 7 feet, the spread of these pellets after passing through a person, the spread of them is probably, that window may be 26 inches wide. So that's going to be the spread. Obviously, there can be some deflection of the pellets as they pass through the body of the victim.
Would that be a variable?
Sure.
Okay. So do you know the spread of a shotgun every yard, how much it spreads, the cone? Do you know how much it spreads per yard?
What kind of choke?
Any choke, any gauge.
I don't know the number off the top of my head.
You don't know. Do you even know it, not even off the top of your head, without looking it up?
I would have to look it up.
Okay. And do you know the range of fire for 10 feet, what that spread is? In centimeters, do you know? Or inches, well, either.
I don't have this committed to memory. I would look it up.
Is that even something you've ever known, or is that something you would have to look up?
Like I said before, I have tested such things before.
I'm not asking for
read
literature.
Objection, but again, it's not something that I have committed to memory. Again, this, you know, if you wanted to know something like that, if that was helpful in this particular case, then what you would do is then you would go to the literature and find those answers. But I don't have that memorized.
Well, aren't you rendering an opinion by drawing a line, by saying somehow that exited the shotgun? I mean, we saw the pictures with you standing there with your shotgun up, and we see this line. Are you not giving an opinion of its exit?
I'm giving an opinion that a pellet from that shotgun followed that line and struck the tree.
And yet you don't even know the cone and the rate of expansion of a shotgun. How can you give that opinion?
You don't need to know that.
Okay.
So because what you have here,
all right,
you got a hole in the window, and we have a slide for it. There's a hole in the window. There is a impact mark on the tree. That pellet traveled a straight distance between those two points, and two points forms a line. You don't need to know the spread. I mean, that's actually what happened was a pellet came out of that gun, it passed through the victim, it went through a hole in the window, and it hit the tree.
How do you know then? How do you know it passed through the victim? How do you know that?
Well, it has 9 pellets in the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Paul had 1 pellet in his shoulder. Sled recovered 7. I recovered 9. So I recovered the last pellet.
All right. So how do you know that? How do you know that? What are you basing that on? What you just testified to, what are you basing that on?
Well, when I looked at the sled records, they found 7 pellets. Or that went through his body. They didn't find all the pellets, but he had 8 entrance wounds. He had 7 exit wounds. They found 1 pellet in his body, so that's 8. But we know the manufacturer puts 9. When I went to the crime scene in October 19 of 2021, the 9th buckshot pellet was in the window frame.
How do you know that was the 9th buckshot pellet that went through? Did you analyze it?
Well,
did you analyze it?
I didn't analyze it, okay. but
are you assuming?
Not allowing him to answer the question. He said, I didn't analyze it, but, and then he interrupted him.
I didn't hear the but. Go ahead.
Oh, so the window got shot, right? Most of the pellets went through the window. Some of the pellets went through the little white parts of the window. There was one pellet that SLED didn't recover, and the reason is it was under kind of the lip. You know how where you pick up on a window, there's a thing where you put your fingers? It was under that, but still there. So you have a pattern of buckshot pellets like this big, and so you got 9 holes, basically, or 8, because there was one pellet left in the victim, right? So
how many?
Nine minus the 1, so you have 8. There are 8 holes in that window. In my world, that's a very high probability that those are the pellets that came from the buckshot that injured Paul Murdoch.
Two slides forward. What's this big thing here at the bottom? That big opening. Exhibit 47.
Are you talking about the missing glass?
Yeah, what is that?
It's missing glass.
All right. How many pellets went through there?
I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but I counted for every pellet, except for the one that was missed by the crime scene investigators, which is under the...
Let's talk about that. How many grains was the pellet you located on the windowsill?
I never weighed it.
Again, how do you know it came from there? Do you really know it came from there, or are you assuming it came from there?
Well, what the window got shot with buckshot, and there's one missing pellet. Again, in my world, there's a very high confidence level that that missing pellet is there.
Is that the same confidence level that you're using for all these other opinions? That?
Yeah.
Found a pellet?
All my opinions are at a very high confidence level.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we're going to go through them.
I object to that question. We're going to get to them. That's what he said.
All right. The court sustains objection to the comment.
The rope here, this orange rope, is that the one that continues back to the tree?
Yes.
All right. Do you have any formal training in what a projectile does if it strikes anything, be it human flesh or glass or any of the other items that would have been located? Do you have any training in that?
Again, not formal training, but it obeys the laws of physics, and I've tested it myself, and I've studied impacts. That's a big part of what I do.
Have you done a test where you shot shotguns through glass, through wood, and through a human body, and then measured where they ended up? Have you done those tests?
No, you don't need to test it because you can just look and see what happened to it.
So is the answer no?
I didn't do any testing with the shotgun here, but why would you need to test? Because I think we got the same slide up there. Would you agree with me? Well, I can't ask you a question, but that pellet right there went through that window and it lodged in a tree or damaged the tree. I don't need to test that because that's just what happened.
Is it your opinion that it can only be that pellet? There's no other possibility. No other possibility. Is that your opinion?
Well, I'm not saying that there might be some highly lower probability, but if you stand in that room and we have holes, and just like you've shown, they're scattered all over that window, and you look in the direction of the damage to the tree where Paul was injured, that is the only one. And I don't think it really matters one way or the other. All I can say is that I think the shot went through Paul in the manner that I presented it today. Okay. It really doesn't matter to me all that much which pellet went through which hole.
And I just want to be clear, you have no formal training in this, no pathological training, correct?
I am not a pathologist. Okay.
But you opine that you believe it went through Paul and then exited the window and struck that tree, but you have no formal training in any of that, correct? No pathology, no firearms, no shotgun-specific training other than anecdotal shooting a shotgun? None of that, no formal trainings. Is that correct?
I would disagree with all of that because, again, you know, it doesn't take a pathologist. There's a small entry wound into Paul's chest. So all 9 pellets enter. 1 remains in his body. 8 leave his body.
You are sitting here opining about pathology. Is that correct?
I don't see how that's pathology. That's simple math. Okay. It's 9 minus 1 is 8.
Exhibit, I don't know what page this is. Exhibit 81 or 80? All right, reverse it. We'll start there. Go back if you wouldn't mind, couple. Yeah, right here. Did you take this picture?
No.
How many inches does that look like he is tall?
Well, you can't tell how tall he is because of the way this picture's taken.
Well, what does it look like?
This shows his shoulder 64 inches.
What about his head?
You can't tell.
You can't see a number at the top of there?
No, because you'd have to be above the top of his head or right in line with the top of his head. The only thing you can glean from this picture is that his shoulder is 64 inches above the floor.
That wraps up our fourth segment of coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh. There is much more to come. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of it here as we continue to follow the case for you. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.